Hello, this is Jolyon Rubinstein and welcome to News Roast. We need your help. Can you please go to the iTunes store and give this podcast a 5-star review and write a really nice thing about it? And then hit the subscribe button. We are coming to the end of season one of News Roast. This is in fact the penultimate episode, but we've got fantastic guests lined up for series two. But unless we can actually make the podcast pay for itself, and that means getting advertised to sponsor episodes, we're not going to be able to continue it. So please, please give the podcast a 5-star review and subscribe on iTunes. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy this metaphorical feast. Hello and welcome to News Roast. My name's Jolyon Rubinstein.
My name's Hayden Prowse.
And this is Three Courses of Conversation. Hayden,
yeah.
You're wearing a very ironic t-shirt today.
What,
it's
Godfrey?
Sort of like...
Joffrey, sorry.
He's wearing a Godfrey, but it's sort of spelt Joffrey as a kind of weird Game of Thronesy kind of reference, but it's like a throwback to the classic butler of Will Smith's iconic book. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
You, on the other hand,
I'm wearing a very
heavily handed political statement.
It says,
thinking strictly prohibited.
Yeah.
Think police, government warning.
It's subtle, I'll give you that. but, you know, that's
you were wearing
just
one the other
styles.
Day with a businessman on a hamster wheel. Tell me, what did that mean?
It meant that rats are being put out of jobs.
Right.
Because hamster wheels are being
wow.
used. Exactly the kind of t-shirt I would hope that you would wear.
I would try to wear this.
Well, because he's a political prankster.
But exactly. He's a kind of like, I don't care.
Adam's saying you're fulfilling your stereotype, basically.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. Right. No, it's good. That's a cynical way of putting it.
Yeah.
Can we just say, after hounding this man on Twitter, have never met him before, so it's a very special moment for us, but this is genuinely one of our absolute comedy heroes.
Absolutely.
The Adam and Joe show, I mean, shut up.
Yeah.
Just stop. The polymathic legend buckles to everyone who's ever listened to his fantastic podcast. The sort of man who you sort of feel you know a bit if you listen to him a lot.
When he just rocked up outside and brought his Brompton,
his Brompton.
Oh, I know he has a Brompton.
I feel like I care for his dog Rosie, even though I've never met her.
Yeah.
This is Adam Buxton.
Hey, how you doing? Wow, there's a lot to talk about there.
Mm.
I mean, you mentioned the Glastonbury coverage that we did. We got home, we did it 2 years. Once in the year 2000 when Bowie played.
Which we'll talk about.
Yeah. And that was fun. And
was that
then,
fun for you, though? Were you just more like just drawn to the Bowie-ness? Maybe you were just like, I must, how can I, could I touch him? Is it possible?
Oh, yeah.
Physical contact, maybe, with your hero.
We were entirely focused on trying to get an interview with him. And we decorated our little set in the BBC area with posters, homemade posters saying, David, come and speak to us. And we did sketches of him, and there were lots of references to all little different parts of his career so that he would know that we were super fans. And I don't know why we thought
super
that was
fans it. Doesn't even no. come close, though, does it? I mean, it's verging on sort of like an alter sort of mental state that you go into whenever you sort of anyone who knows anything about Adam Buxton knows the love of the Bowie.
I do love him, yeah.
I mean, the special episode was, I mean, genuinely, I actually cried listening to you talking about how much you cared about him.
You cried listening to me crying.
But I hadn't cried
about
it
other
before.
People crying.
It was so incredible.
I love crying.
It's a good thing to get out now.
But short version of the story was that we didn't get an interview with him. He didn't give an interview to anyone that year. But we heard later from Alan Yentob that it was down to, he was considering doing an interview with either Joe Wiley or with us.
Yeah.
Because he'd seen our show. So we were pleased about that. Obviously, it would have been better if
he'd actually given
it. But then when you think that.
But maybe it wouldn't.
It's a close second.
Yeah. You and Joe Wiley, like, that's a pretty good, like, level to be at, of all people.
And he was on good form as well. He played a good set.
But were the BBC a bit nervous about you interviewing people because of the fact that they thought you'd just take the piss out of anyone?
They never expressed anxiety about that, and quite rightly, because we would never have done that, really. I mean, we were silly with people, and people were suspicious of us. I remember Tejinder Singh from Corner Shop was very surly.
Brimful of Asher on the 45.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's a serious guy, and he thought that we were just silly people, which was true.
But you're mirth makers.
Yeah. Also, a lot of work had gone into it. It wasn't as if we were just I saw a thing. I was looking at a thing of you guys the other day. Oh, right, I think it was you, Hayden, outside the Apple store antagonizing people in a queue.
That's what I do.
And I like the fact that you included the bit of the guy just saying, "You are a cockend! You are," and he was so angry with you that he was trying to think of funny insults, but he wasn't quite managing it, and it was just like, "You are a bell white cock man! You are stupid cock shit!" And you were just stood there in your pith helmet nodding.
Hello there, lovely listener. I've just had to step away from our metaphorical roast to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Loot Crate. Who are Loot Crate, I hear you ask? Well, let me tell you, they're the industry leaders in entertainment, gaming, sports, and pop culture, delivered in a monthly fleens crate to your door every single month. Doesn't that sound badass? Now, if like me, you're a massive fan of like the Marvel franchises, shows like Stranger Things, Jessica Jones, The X-Files, are into gaming, things from Nintendo, love Teenage Ninja Mutant Ninja Turtles, whatever they're called, or Superman, or frankly whatever, then this is for you. Each month, Loot Crate delivers you a box that of unspeakably cool little things like comics, wearables, figurines, all sorts of stuff that you can keep yourself. Or if you're like me and you've got a number of godchildren, a number of, you know, nephews and nieces, you can just, you know, you can just be the man with all the goodies. So go to www.lootcrate.com, and when you get to the checkout, put in the promo code ROAST and you'll get a 10% discount before the 19th. And for as little as £22 a month, you can receive the latest box. Sign up before the 19th and you'll get that 10% discount if you put in the code ROAST. Thank you very much, and back to our dining experience. It's one of the best things, actually.
I think it's actually distorted mine and Jolyon's social relationships, because for us that's normal. So yeah. If, you know, having people just directing their ire towards us, just like,
well, yeah. We don't like it. I mean, Joe always claimed to be more thick-skinned than I did, but if there's any confrontation, then both of our voices immediately betray our level of anxiety, and our faces start twitching, and you know, it's very, very obvious when we're in a confrontation. So it doesn't work. You know, we would rather get on well with people. When we did the corner shop interview, we'd made a robot out of a bin, and we decorated it, and it looked like a real bin robot.
Obviously it had buckles.
And it had lights and everything. I mean, I took a week to build this fucking robot. Yeah. Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah. Fucking no, you fucking can't fucking swear, okay?
And
I felt good.
It was pretty great, the robot, if I say so myself. And then I made a whole load of sort of generic questions and comments and loaded them onto a mini disc. That was the technology in those days. And then I crouched down underneath the table, and while we were interviewing people like Badly Drawn Boy and Orbital and Corner Shop, who happened to be around, I would fire off random questions from the robot. I mean, it wasn't good. Like, the work that had gone into it was laudable, but the actual end result was not entertaining or funny.
It's because you guys...
And that sums
really
up a lot of my career.
Fucked with formats way back in the day when people weren't doing it. Like, you know, things like the Eric Andre show now are doing similar things to that, and it's considered really groundbreaking. But you guys were kind of doing that in the Adam and Joe show, you know.
Well, that
10,
was the legacy of...
Longer.
American cable you know, public access. And there was a guy called Jake Fogelnest, who's still around doing bits and pieces.
Jake Fogelnest.
Yeah, you can follow him on Twitter, and he's involved with a lot of music stuff. But he did a show called Squirt TV when he was a young teen, living with his parents in New York. And a lot of people took the mick out of him for being a little sort of spoilt middle class boy. Oh, you got your own camera, you got your own TV show. And there was an element of that, but I suppose that was true of us as well. However, he was making this show in his own bedroom, and he had bands in, and he would cut up bits of video. I remember he had a segment on his show where it was just some footage of people disco dancing in Saturday Night Fever, and he'd put a hip-hop track that was the same BPM.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems prehistoric, but literally, I'd never seen that before. Someone mashing something up like that was an entirely alien concept. And I just thought, oh, this is just terrific. And obviously then it was a lot easier because there was none of the... Or rather, there were fewer clearance implications, and people were a bit more easygoing about it if they thought that it was a goof.
In your Sky Atlantic series,
Bugged.
The fact I just laugh out loud moments where you read people's comments on YouTube, but you read it like as it's been written. It's because then suddenly you realise how much nonsense it is and how it's just complete drivel.
When did you just realise that actually, if I just took these comments and talked about them, then I had an entire show? Because that is a unique. Like, Bugged is not really like anything else.
Well, it was just... It's a show that I've been doing since about 2007 at the BFI. And originally it was just we would show music videos and that would be it. And I'd literally be on stage and I'd say, there you go, that was Aphex Twin. Here's the new one from Polly Harvey or whatever. And then in the course of putting the show together, I would look at the videos. I'd get the list of videos we were going to show from the people who... curate the show, and then I would watch them on YouTube a lot of the time, and so it was still early days for YouTube, 2007, but I accidentally, I think, under a Polly Harvey video one day, sort of scrolled down and saw, oh, people have left words underneath this. What are they? what is the point? Why would they want to do that? Who cares? And then instantly was entertained by their wrong-headed and loudly stated opinions. And sometimes not wrong-headed, sometimes sort of semi-insightful and interesting. And back in those days, there used to be lengthier debates that would go on. I've noticed now that people just fire off a single comment and they can't be bothered to go back and get embroiled in a big... That's not always true.
But that's the best stuff to watch.
But that's the nicest... I like it when there's a dialogue.
The one direction is that lose it at each other.
Oh, that's really vicious.
That's on another level, isn't
it?
Like,
yeah.
They are really like...
And the another level fans.
Oh, wowzers.
Whoa. That's on a One Direction level.
That's... No, I mean, it's almost five. I wonder if Take That and Five with Another Level could take One Direction.
Oh, I think so. Okay, let's move on to our courses. So Adam's here, Adam Buxton. We're very, very excited about that. And he's brought us three courses of conversation. So, Adam, do you enjoy a three-course meal? Generally, not a metaphorical one, an actual physical real one that goes in your mouth.
Generally, it's not a part of my routine, but I enjoy it whenever I get the opportunity. If I go to a restaurant with my beautiful wife, my wife, then it's very exciting to have the three courses.
Yeah.
And I talked to my friend Garth Jennings on my podcast about the best meal we ever had in a fancy French restaurant that was about 10 courses. Like, courses.
Wowzers.
More courses.
But your very famous courses. Father Bad Dad, he was a big fan of the old culinariness.
He was a gourmand in a way, yeah. He was
a gourmand, yeah.
He had more sophisticated taste in a lot of areas than I do. I'm very happy with more or less the same meal from Pret every day.
In terms of a metaphorical starter, could you tell us what you brought for that?
Right, well, I mean, I did say to you, Jolyon and I were on in Twitter contact, and in the course of setting up this meeting, I did say several times, you know, I'm a silly comedian man, and I don't have that much of value to say on a lot of...
Buckles, don't make me quote what I actually sent you to convince you, which was basically that you're a super legend and that Buckles can talk about anything he wants.
Well, that's generous.
And that's the whole point. So but we can just go into, you know, let's not be trying to, like, be... Me and Hayden have tried for a long time to be things that we aren't, and it hasn't worked out well for us.
Yeah.
Now we're just trying to be
You've sent me off on a tangent, and this is not related to the
Jesus
news,
Christ.
But I'm going to put you guys on the spot and make you feel uncomfortable, seeing as that's what you like to do to other people.
We're ready.
Right?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
When I came in, when I met you guys in the street, you were clearly having a tiff.
Yeah.
Like you were gesticulating. Yeah. Hayden, you're it was really demonstrative.
He was pulsating, wasn't he?
I was like, are they having a row?
Yeah.
Or is that, are they just fooling around?
I told you, I said that we just had a tiff.
Yeah. I mean, I know this is strictly speaking a bit rude to bring up, but I thought you guys,
do you want to talk about that,
if anyone starter? Would be happy to entertain something that was a bit uncomfortable, it might be you. Exactly. So what were you rowing about?
Is this your official starter?
Yeah, I want to talk
good,
about
because also you know
this
he
is
was
good.
Part
we
of, you know, Adam and Joe.
Double act dynamics.
I mean that is double act dynamics. I was going to suggest
had a
this.
Favorite
interesting.
Theme
okay, you're throwing
of mine.
A googly into the. Okay, well what
and
happened
you
was
are, yeah. Before we get into this. It's interesting for me because I'm out of that whole thing. Me and Joe now have a sort of gentle pensioner loving relationship. But there was a time when we were still sort of working a lot together where it was very stressful and we used to have tense
massive
times,
rows.
You know. So yeah. I maybe I can be like a therapist for you guys and help
so
you
nice.
Avoid some of the pitfalls.
An older wiser.
Yeah. So what was I mean, yeah. So,
we're
so
a bit
what,
of a thing is we get
on?
We're a bit of a sort of like, you know, we joke about it, but it's sort of like we're the political Anton Deck.
Yeah.
You know, so people know us as one thing, but we're very, very different.
Sure.
And then, you know, I'll have a go at chasing him about something and he'll be like, yeah, but when
so
you
what happened was,
when you didn't I'll call it, me and tell me.
So what,
that,
what Julian has a tendency to do is ooh. Be very, very, very like a sort of
it's very loaded language,
like a dad,
yeah,
like a dad about things. You know,
yes.
When your dad like nags you about something in a really annoying way, like really slightly like on your case a little bit too much when you're already doing it. Like you're supposed to have cleaned your room, you're fucking doing it, and it's just like constant. He'll do that, but then he won't do. He'll like constantly be late or fuck something up or miss a deadline, but then he'll turn around and like really nag you about your deadline. It's so annoying because it's like, why don't you just deal with your deadline rather than nagging me about my deadline?
Is this the first time you've been able to speak about
this? No, it's not. No. But the difference is, you see,
this is good.
I say he's right and then say sorry, whereas sorry is not part of his vocabulary because he's dead inside, which is the truth.
Are you guys
he's lacking
similar
in all sort of
backgrounds?
Yes.
He's posher than I am. He likes to pretend he's more street, but he's posher.
Well, I mean, the thing that characterizes people of our vague social ilk is that we find talking about these things quite difficult.
Yes.
And I've said already that I can't do it because my voice instantly goes wobbly as soon as there's something real being talked about. Mm.
We talk about them all the time. To be fair, me and Julian have been through so many. It's really stressful doing what we do.
Yes,
and
but you're able to do those confrontational things with members of the public. That's something
probably
I could never do.
Probably because we have the confrontation with each other all the time.
No, I don't think
that's it. It comes to a confrontation with the public, which is like,
well, I think what we've done is, I think that's a very good point, which is, as you'll know, when you're working on a TV show suddenly, you basically are spending an inordinate amount of time with other human beings that you would just never do in normal life. Like if you were with your best mates and suddenly you had to work 6 days a week with them and then you had a drunk with them because you're going somewhere with them, you would just have rows, you just would. But that's the kind of reality suddenly you're put in, and suddenly that's going on for basically 4 months. But when you've then got to have creative conversations together where you really got to bring your best selves to it, that gets progressively harder and harder because stuff builds up and you haven't really got time because you've got to learn scripts. But I think particularly with what we do, there's a sort of strange dichotomy, which is that we're kind of like two people playing a really long 10-year game of chicken, where we're sort of going to each other, go on then, go on.
You do
I bet
it.
You,
you
won't.
Go over to that
I bet
guy.
You won't.
Right.
And then it's like, yeah, I will. And then you go, all right, go on then. Because, to the point where, you know, I remember receiving a text message whilst I was trying to wait for Dick Cheney, right, which never got into the show because, as I'll tell you another time, there was a crippled army veteran who was talking to, who I could have got right in front of, but I didn't think it was right. And I get this text basically being like, oh yeah, got Bill Clinton. And he's like in a Democrat sort of, where were you again?
We were in a a Clinton Foundation event.
But it had taken you 2 days or something, hadn't it?
Yeah, it took 2 days to get
to him. What did you do with him once you'd got him?
Well, the idea was I was playing the Liberal, Barnaby Plankton, and Jolyon was the Tory, James Twottington Burbage, and we were in coalition together. Well, we had a coalition. And the idea was we were in America, going around America, these two characters, and Barnaby goes to a Clinton Foundation event to get some advice from Bill, and he asks him, Bill, you know, I've got into bed with somebody that perhaps I shouldn't have.
It's
and
a very
they keep,
sticky situation.
They keep forcing bills down my throat that I really don't want to swallow. We're in a really sticky situation, and I was wondering if you had any advice, if you get my jizz. So that was the...
Right.
He so owned Clinton.
We had this long conversation with loads of puns like that, and he eventually got it and was quite pissed off. But getting to him was...
Oh, just the thought of it makes me sad.
Getting to him was next to impossible because the first stab we had at it, And in America, it's like...
Stab's probably not the best
this,
word.
Yeah, the first bomb we had. No, in the UK, it's kind of... I mean, it's still difficult getting to David Cameron, but it's not on another level in the States. There's, like, you know, security services everywhere. Like, you can never leave your press minder if you go to an event like that. And we got into the front of this speech that Bill was giving, and I was in the front row sort of waiting for him to come off his podium to walk to the door. And I had, like, five steps to get to him to do my line, and they were sort of filming from the back. And he sort of came off the podium, and I kind of ran up to him to kind of do my line with my radio mic on. They were filming me. And these Secret Service guys grabbed me and, like, shoved me up against the wall. Like, what are you doing, man? And I was like, oh, no, it's fine. I'm a liberal. And I met Bill in the UK.
Nice.
And then we got on very well. I just wanted to have a chat with him. So, like, okay, man, okay. And they kind of, I'd fucked it. And we're like, ah, fuck. And then the PR guys were on us, and they were like, you know, you guys are trying to fuck with Bill. What are you doing? We're going to kick you out of the conference. Yada, yada, yada. And they wouldn't let us go anywhere without them at that point. So we were like, fuck, we're not going to get this. Next day, we managed to sneak into another event. They found us in there with our cameras, and they're like, what the fuck are you doing? We know you're trying to do something to Bill Clinton. Yeah. So they made us leave. So we left our cameras outside, took these little tiny action cams that fit in your hand back in, so they didn't know we had cameras, waited at the back of the conference room, and as he came off stage, ran towards the front, ducked around three different PR guys who were standing in front of me specifically so I wouldn't do that, got to Bill, and the Secret Service guys grabbed me again. Went, what are you doing, man? And one guy went, no, it's okay. He's the liberal from yesterday. And they brought me up to Bill, and then I made loads
and
of jokes about jizz.
Oh,
but this is
and
the
then
thing.
Did they manhandle you out after you'd done the jizz jokes?
We then know there was sort of a bit of confusion.
What did Bill say? Because I'm sorry, I didn't see that one. But then was he sort of saying...
He said, no.
Have you got any advice? No.
He knew what was going on. He's a very clever man. He's, you know. But I think the thing is, like, these are just remarkably stressful situations we're talking about. And the thing is, when you're doing them quite regularly, because as you know, TV is always the limit of the time and the money, and you suddenly have to do a lot of them in a very short period of time, so you've become very sort of used to doing that stuff. And we would have, we've had the most blazing rows in front of entire crews, you wouldn't believe, and to the point where people have resigned. And the reason is because for us... Because we've known each other since we were eight, it's not that big a deal. Like, we'll argue or whatever, but it's
well,
just
that's
like,
good
oh,
because
you're
it
you.
Comes out. The thing with me and Joe was that it was that simmering middle class tension.
Oh, it's the worst. We used to really do that.
I've always been interested in this with you and Joe. Like, I kind of guessed that there might have been some sort of underlying tension at some point, but like, I was interested to. Would you like to talk about that with us, Adam?
I was hoping to turn the tables on you and make you feel uncomfortable,
but
I've talked about it. I've talked about it before, I think what was difficult for us was suddenly having our friendship turn into this professional arrangement, and the dynamic suddenly shifted from us just being delighted by what each other had to offer to us being quite critical. Like, why isn't he pulling his weight more? I'm always in the office before he is.
Oh my god,
I spend longer on the models, I pay more attention to the details than he does. And then he would be rightly thinking, you know, he might think the opposite, like, why are you wasting time on details that don't matter? You should be concentrating on thinking of funny jokes. And you know, these were all valid points of view, but we never talked about them. We just got
did
resentful about them. No.
Did you never express
no,
it?
No, it would always come out in arguments about other much more trivial things.
Yeah,
and
that's
they,
the
and
worst,
they would
isn't it?
Sort of explode. And, you know, I've talked about this before, but we ended up having a big row about what the best games console was at the time. Was it the... Nintendo or was it the PlayStation? And I was like, it's obviously the Nintendo. It's really fun. I don't care. I'm not a big fucking gamer. But suddenly we were just, I was just like, yeah, well, you would think it was the PlayStation, wouldn't you? Because that's it's typical. And it's just like, oh, yeah, it's on TV and lots of rock stars. Like, we used to play a lot of Nintendo. So suddenly, like, you really love PlayStation.
How long have you two known each other?
Since we were 12.
Right.
Yeah.
It's
fucking weird.
It's almost
isn't it?
Like your relationship hasn't progressed from that. It's like stayed the same,
yeah,
some kind of vacuum.
Yeah. But I mean, that's partly because perhaps we never had a fully balanced relationship in the first place. Perhaps we satisfied in each other just a very specific set of needs and
And that's definitely it.
And we were going elsewhere for our emotion. Like, Joe was never someone that I spoke to about having my heart broken or whatever.
Really? God, I've tried speaking to him about that. It's a nightmare.
Do you speak about me all the time?
So there's Adam and Joe. There's us two. I mean, you could have Ant and Dexy, what
any,
they felt.
Any double what, act has
you know,
this.
The thing that killed me.
Armstrong and Miller.
They had a therapy group.
Should we set up a therapy group for double acts?
Noel and Julian.
Honestly, yeah, anyone.
Richard and Judy.
Noel and Julian, I think, were good at, things would come to a head and they would have a big bust up and then they would cry and hug. And
I know, I heard that too. The one that really got me the worst was I got my dad a Peter Cook and Dudley Moore book.
And
then read some of it and was like, closed it like, oh my God, we're just bound to hate each other because it's very hard. Like most double acts go on to either get angry or resent because, and this is a natural thing of the double act, you at some point go your own ways and do things and then you become resentful of each other.
And you go through
the work that you do.
We, because we were having such terrible rows, we actually saw someone.
Did you?
Together, yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it has completely, I still find him as annoying as I always did.
But it's given you a language
I now have a sort of, I have the mechanisms for dealing with it.
Yeah. What actually happened was we paid a lot of money and he said he'd do a lot of stuff, none of which he's done, because he's remained exactly the same. But now he thinks he's got this smugness, like, I went to this therapy session with you.
It's going to work for you as well, mate.
But that's all that therapy is, isn't it? Is a catalyst, supposedly a neutral space. I mean, the danger is always that other deeper things will come out that actually don't serve a useful purpose if they're aired, and then they will poison the relationship going forward. And that's the gamble you take, I think, with therapy.
Well, I think,
but who did you look up?
We were with this amazing woman. I don't think we should name her.
We were recommended someone who does this in, you know, she does it in board
business
level,
right? Okay,
sort of circles, and she does it for, you know, and she kind of did it for us.
Yeah, it was like a personal,
she was quite
professional
interested
partnership.
In, she did it almost, well, we paid her, but, you know, she did it, for a discount because she was kind of interested in the dynamic or something. But it was, I don't know, like, it's interesting how you say that you didn't talk about this stuff. And actually, I totally agree with you. Like, getting this stuff out in a constructive way is the only way to deal with these things. And it's not just about professional relationships, it's also about relationships. You know,
it's so weird. This is a thing that's come back probably about, in the series of 12 podcasts we've done, I reckon this has come up about 4 or 5, maybe 6 times now. Well, it keeps coming back, which is like
double
lack
dynamics.
Of empathy. Well, not just that, like, we live in a very strange society at the minute. Like, if you look at Trump and Brexit is the kind of tipping points of people just throwing a sort of, you know, Molotov cocktail into a system, being like, fuck it, see what happens. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we've got this really impossible situation at the minute where it feels like people still, throughout social media, throughout everything, can't talk about how they feel. They can't really express the upset they have with people, the frustrations, because you've got to kind of, like, you know, be a man, or, like, you know, man, not talk about how you feel, or just expect that you can just get on with stuff, and it destroys people.
Or, as I say,
it?
You don't want to look wishy-washy. That's still seen as being like the worst kind of crime, as being someone who sees both sides of the coin. It's like, you fucking moron, nail your colours to the flag.
So true.
And you're part of the problem. This sort of wishy-washy thinking is the reason that we get steamrolled by these autocrats and monsters. And I don't know. I see the truth in
you
that.
You can see both sides.
I totally agree.
It's torture.
If I was a politician, I always think I'd, you know, people ask me a question, be like, I don't know, I'm of two minds about that one.
I've been recommending to people in double acts that they go and see a therapist at a certain point.
Oh, my
for
God.
For ages and ages. Because I think
maybe you and Joe should. Do you need to anymore?
Well, now it's moot. I think we've moved beyond the point where...
What about the Spielberg reference?
No.
What about the Spielberg story you tried to tease out of him? He wasn't very happy about that, was he?
He wasn't happy.
So what Adam did was basically, if you don't know, so basically what Adam did was...
Is this in the last Adam and Joe podcast?
No, this was a while ago. This is maybe last
November 2015.
He got Adam Joe, he got Joe round.
Yeah.
And then he started wheedling him with his little finger. And he was like, oh, so you don't want to tell that story then? You don't want to tell that story then? Oh, I might make you tell it. When he was in a room with Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise, and the first thing Adam started saying to him was, what did Tom Cruise do? Did he do weird stuff? And Joe clearly being like, well, there's no way Tom Cruise is going to hear this, but hang on, maybe he will. Hang on, maybe he really will. And then Adam, sensing this dissatisfaction, starts going, no, 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 no. and just pushing it. And there's a joy to it. Like, as someone who's listened to so much of your radio shows and stuff, like, it's fucking hilarious. But I also felt really bad for Joe.
Did you? I mean, I think there were a lot of people who were angry with him. I think you're right to feel sorry for him. I was being annoyed.
I was empathizing with both sides.
Well,
there.
Good for you. But there were some people who were like, you guys, you've lost it. I used to listen to your radio show. You used to get on really well. It was fun hearing you be friends. And now Joe won't even tell you the doodle story. And it's pathetic to listen to. And I thought it was funny too. But and also, I know the doodle story. He has told it to me before. It was about...
Holy shit. Are you going to drop the doodle story
No,
now?
I'm not, because you I don't not. Want to antagonize Joe.
Joe, you're welcome to come on anytime you want and tell us the
tell
doodle
us when
story.
We're off air?
It's, yeah, I'll tell you, okay, sure.
Yes.
But it's not something that is going to change your life. Trust me.
I just thought it was... could be like the secret,
I thought it was
though.
A funny thing. But anyway, I was frustrated because it winds me up when, especially... celebrities these days just shut you down. And it's like, no, I can't talk about that. I've signed NDA or I don't know what.
God.
And it's like, you can talk around it. You don't have to throw anyone under the bus. You know, I'm not asking you to reveal to me that Tom Cruise is a shitbag or anything. I just want a...
What are you talking about?
Tom
Cruise is like the nicest guy.
So I hear.
apparently he's great.
I feel like there's a way of talking about pretty much anything without... ruining your life or the lives
That's
of
true.
Others.
Yeah. No, because otherwise it just becomes sort of really bland and anodyne, doesn't it? And it's not... like, in fact, your one you did with Joe over Christmas, last Christmas, I thought you were maybe back to that a little bit, and you were both kind of gunning people a little bit and taking the piss a little bit, and it was kind of felt a bit more like the old Adam and Joan.
Well, there's always a way of... as I say, there's always a way of doing it that acknowledges that you're not Lily White yourself and that we're all flawed. And this is just your perspective on something.
Except Hayden. Hayden is not flawed. That's what you've got to remember.
I'm
always.
So glad you finally... this is what we came to the realization.
Finally,
when we met the therapist, as she said, Hayden, you're perfect. And Jolene, you have a lot of work to do.
You know,
and it helped us.
And I'm trying. He's trying to be less perfect, it's which is basically impossible.
As well, for a double act to be, you know, that you fulfill different needs in each other. You're different. Personalities, right?
Yeah.
So it's important for one person to be like... in my relationship with Joe, I ended up by default being the kind of person that was always talking about his feelings the whole time. And
you're me.
When you're in a marriage, and this has happened with my wife as well, like, I never used to be someone who was that
my wife
calm or that laid back, but because my wife has become someone who is quite uptight about details and certain things, I have, by default, become like the, soon come. You know.
The rain will come, don't worry.
Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine.
Yeah,
and,
it's
true.
You,
and the more I do that, the more it winds her up. She's like, it's not going to be fine. We've got to fucking sort this out. And the arrangements need to be made. And have you checked this? I'm like, honestly, don't worry about it.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's not that you have a kind of, you know, immobile, unchangeable character. You become different things for different people all
and
the time.
And it's silly because I am a warrior. I always used to be that person going, have we checked that this is all in place? And now, because it suits this dynamic, I have taken the role of the laid back guy.
Do you know the other thing I read recently in a psychological journal I was reading was, and it's so true, it's like one of those old truisms, but you hate the things you love. So, you know, the things that I love the most about Hayden will be the things that wind me up the most about him, just depending on what mood you're in. It's like you'll really look at a quality
in
someone
one day.
Wait, you
said the things you hate about him
are also the things you love. They're the same things.
Give me an example.
Well, no, I don't want to.
No.
But like, what I'm talking about is
having
that,
caused
I think
this.
In most relationships, Adam
is backing out of it.
In most
hastily.
Relationships, you kind of have that dynamic with someone where it's also the things that are probably closest to your personality.
It's the things that are actually
most like you. You're like, how dare you be so like this? Because this is not acceptable. When actually, what you're saying is to yourself,
right? Yeah.
You are not acceptable.
This is getting very touchy feely. I don't mind. I like this kind of stuff. The bedrock of a lot of that, though, is self-loathing, though, isn't it?
Exactly.
And
isn't it?
You fundamentally have to... you know, it's things you're dissatisfied with in yourself that you end up projecting on other people. Or you see those same failings in other people and you think, yuck, you're awful, I've got to get away from you because you're me. I hate me.
Thank you.
Listen, let's go on to the main course and stop being so navel-gazy. Sure. So I believe that you had an interesting podcast that you had listened to by a certain Malcolm Gladwell.
Right. So did you guys listen to this?
We've listened to it many times.
I'm talking about a podcast series he did called Revisionist History. And
great
the last
series.
In the series was one called The Satire Paradox.
Satire Paradox.
In which he interviewed Harry Enfield. That was jarring in itself to hear a show coming from a very American perspective opening up with Harry Enfield talking about doing loads of money and saying that he felt that Loads of Money ended up doing more harm than good as a character. For people who haven't listened to the podcast or aren't familiar with Loads of Money as a character, Harry Enfield, genius comedian, had this character that he played called Loads of Money. Painter and decorator and epitomized everything that Harry Enfield felt was wrong with the post-Thatcher generation of people that were motivated just by lining their own pockets and making money. And if they were making lots of ready cash, which they could do in a Thatcherite economy, then that was fine. And they were all brash. And they were like, whereas the working classes in the past had been these people who were fighting against that and trying to make society fairer or had an interest in society being fairer, suddenly here were these people flashing their wads and going, I got loads of money. And so the character was supposed to be satirizing that, but then it got taken up by those people themselves.
The Boys, the
sort of white van man or whatever. And they thought it was great. And I think even Thatcher herself thought it was like, yay, great. This is,
amazing,
it was used as a criticism, the Loads of Money society, kind of people being self-interested. Mm. But as far as she was concerned, it was like, yeah, well, what's the problem? Yeah, there's more money to go
around.
Greed
is good.
So, exactly. It's the kind of Gordon Gekko mentality. So Harry Enfield was saying like, yeah, I don't know if it did any good. And then that got Gladwell off on a whole...
Well, he did the Saturday Night Live thing, then,
right,
didn't
with
he?
Tina Fey and Sarah Palin, and saying that that didn't. But then that didn't actually do much good, and it was toothless. He described.
Well, what he was saying was that one week they were barracking her and mimicking her and Tina Fey's brilliant character, but the next week Sarah Palin was actually presenting Saturday Night Live as if nothing could be funnier than cuddling up with the person who you're basically. Yeah. You know, ripping,
sports,
satirically
basically.
Taking. And what his point was that kind of had sort of, it not had just made the sketch toothless, but it rendered the nature of the work, which was supposed to be satirically sort of, gouging her policies out, suddenly it rendered it completely obsolete because it was like, actually, we like her enough to invite her on. And she's not.
I think that's a legitimate criticism.
I do too.
Because the response that I read to the piece, yesterday I found something online with someone...
a comments page.
It wasn't a comment, it was a proper article that someone had... A blog post, I guess.
Not reviews.
But they were saying, actually, Gladwell's wrong about this, and there's evidence to show that people's attitudes to Sarah Palin changed in the wake of Tina Fey's impressions of her on Saturday Night Live, and people were less... well disposed towards Tina Fey, so kind of job done was the implication, you know what I mean? But actually the whole business of getting Tina Fey on the show herself,
you mean Sarah Palin,
sorry,
it's so funny that it's become interchangeable. Yeah. Getting Tina Fey on Saturday Night Live,
well,
fuck
it's the
me,
way you talk
stuff.
About movie characters, isn't it?
It's
you
true.
Seldom use the character's name, you sort of say, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, it's yeah. Jeff Bridges anyway. Getting Sarah Palin on that show, yeah, I would say that is kind of problematic.
It's weird, isn't it? I mean, we live in a very strange time now, and we've discussed this before. I mean, when we had John Lloyd on, his take, and I mean, that's a man that knows about satire, was satire don't do shit, which was kind
that's
of
what
the,
he was saying.
Yeah,
he was saying it's like
chat.
A sort of like a release pressure valve that kind of gets released, and then it stops people from taking more serious action because they've watched.
I mean, that's
image.
What musicians say about political songs a lot of the time.
Yeah,
I've heard that point of
but
view.
But the thing
saying,
is, I find it kind of interesting that it was just as an example. So I had to do this interview a couple of days ago for NME about kind of talking about about Saturday Night Live now. Because obviously you've got Melissa McCartney doing the fabulous Sean Spicer. You've got, Alec Baldwin killing it as Donald Trump. And I sort of said, which is kind of how I feel, that it's kind of like, as much as I love watching Jamie Foxx playing Ray Charles, and I think it's absolutely genius, I sort of see that the same way. You know, like Spicer... actually was talking about Melissa McCarthy earlier
this
week.
McCarthy?
McCarthy, yes, sorry, you're right.
I disagree with Gladwell's position because I actually... So Saturday Night Live the other day had... what's her name? Love of my life.
Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson hosting.
Is she the love of your life?
Yeah, she is. She doesn't
What's
know
not
it.
To love?
And
Ghost in the Shell.
Their best sketch in that episode was this one where they have a dog and they're playing scientists. I don't know if you saw this. Did you see this?
No, I didn't.
They're playing scientists.
Where do you watch it? You
can watch it on their YouTube. All the best sketches, anyway.
On the YouTube.
Yeah. They're playing scientists, and Scarlett Johansson has brought her dog in, who's a little pug, and they've developed some software which allows you to hear the dog's thoughts. And they're talking to the dog, and it turns out the dog is a Trump supporter, and they've got all the funders of the scientific research in there, and they're disgusted that this dog is making absolutely total reasonable sense about why maybe Trump is a good thing and investment in infrastructure and needed to shake up the system and all this kind of stuff, and they're already shocked and they don't want to be involved in the technology anymore, even though it's incredible. Because the dog's a Trump supporter. But that was one of the first times, or one of the few times, that they break out of their little bubble. And what Gladwell is really, he has a very, you know, he knows what his political opinion
is. It's quite didactic, isn't it?
Yeah, but he's a left of centre journalist / author.
It's in his interests to...
to push a certain type
pin
of...
pin his colours to a particular mask.
Exactly.
Even if that mask later gets bent and topples.
But it's really good when satire... talks to both sides of the argument, and I think the confusion isn't the confusion is you need to go one step back. Satire was never a way of tearing down the system. It never did that, and to assume it does that in a sort of slightly less effective way than political than protesting or political action is just a false assumption, because it was never supposed to do that. It was supposed to...
I don't know. I think the thing is, what we do is very different, because what we do is basically a form of sort of characters in the real world, but they are quite protestory. I mean, we're literally going straight up to David Cameron's face and basically putting a finger
sure.
up and going...
Sure, but when you're Del Maley and you go and take the piss out of protesters, yeah. I laugh at the jokes you're making when you go, get out the way, hippie.
Yeah.
I'm laughing at that fucking hippie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm not just laughing at your satirisation of the Daily Mail journalist.
I'm a huge Saturday Night Live fan. I'm sure you are too, Adam. And Lorne Michaels has been for years and years making this show. And I think he reacts to the environment around him. I don't think Saturday Night Live is a deeply satirical sort of show. It's about brilliant performers bringing brilliant material. Mm. It's just that the real world right now is so comical in America, or tragic, depending on the way you want to look at it. And I don't know whether... I mean, I don't know. What do you think that Alec Baldwin being Trump is satire, even if Trump does get in contact with him? Would you define it like
that? Well, it's a bit like Peter Serafinowicz's sassy Trump things, you know. And I love Peter, and I think those are really funny. And I actually now, whenever I look at Trump, I'm surprised that he has the voice he does rather than Peter's voice, you know. But I sort of find myself wondering, like, I wonder what difference these things do make, and I wonder how they do change people's opinions. And I don't know. I mean, definitely the spitting image caricatures of certain politicians, David Steele, tiny little David Steele puppet, and he was in the pocket and David Steele pointed to that characterization of him as being something that destroyed his career, more or less, because people just wrote him off as being this totally ineffectual guy.
It's funny though, because now it's more like it then became popular culture, I think, because the left thought they'd won. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a genius to see that, like, Craig David with my little bird Kez. I mean, where Kez came from, I have no idea. Craig but that David. Kind of chased Craig David out of the UK, didn't it?
He was really hurt by that.
And that really upset the band.
He really blamed that stuff for
not
a
just
slump
on Friday as well.
And he's back.
He did it on Monday and Tuesday. He was
but,
pissed
you know,
off about
it's
it on Wednesday.
Not really. It's not really up to comedians, is it, to dictate political policy and to effect political change? Isn't that up to politicians and voters?
This is what's so fucked right now, isn't it, Adam? It's like, you know, we had the wonderful Lily Allen on recently, and we've had James O'Brien on, and James O'Brien on one of his famous rants. Do you know, are you familiar with the old James O'Brien of LBC fame?
I think I've seen him.
He's
briefly.
A lovely chap. You'd like him a lot. And he was saying that, you know, it's weird because, like, the commentariat has all become quite, like, snipey, wannabe, you know, ankle to Katie Hopkins. And the only people fucking standing up are Lily Allen and Gary Lineker. Uh-huh. I mean, what's going on in the world? And the thing is that in these very strange times, I think certainly, I mean, look, it's different for us. Our whole thing was always about, you know, taking difficult issues kind of dressing them up like trash TV in a way, making them a funny little morsel, and hopefully through an animation or something, getting people to know a bit more about, say, I don't know, BP and Deepwater Horizon, or how the National Gallery was sponsored by Finmeccanica and an Italian arms dealer. But those were kind of packages of little bits of knowledge rather than just like really, really accurate parodies of politicians in the mainstream, which sort of feels like, I mean, Spinning Image is so different, Saturday Night Live. I mean, what do you think of the old, you know, Melissa
McCarthy?
I don't think I've even seen it because
Seen Spicy?
So
wow.
Good.
Yeah. No, I don't know if I've seen it. This is the Saturday Night Live thing.
Yeah. This is Trump's new spokesman.
Do you feel a little bit like if you put yourself in the public eye, then the sort of trade-off is that you should be willing to accept a little bit of piss-taking?
Grief.
Yeah. You should be able to own or just not be offended by it.
Oh, man, I've always found that a bit of a lame way of thinking about things.
Yeah.
I think, you know, people deserve respect unless they absolutely piss in your face. You know what I mean? So if someone's whole mission, whether they're in the public eye or not, is to antagonize me, then I'll give them some grief.
So, but do you also think maybe it's the medium? Like, people are assuming if you want satire, you know, satire has been damaging to people over the years. If you were, you know, handing out leaflets prior to the French Revolution, taking the piss out of Louis XVI, they probably would have had some kind of effect. But you're talking about TV, you know, this is just an entertainment medium. If you want to do satire, and people do it all the time, you know, and they release it on their own through YouTube or whatever, you can do some damaging satire. You know,
well, people used to, you see, when they did the old UK Uncut stuff and the Vodafone stores, that's when it was actually doing
when
something.
It was protest,
when it was like they would turn, for instance, like a bank, they turned into a hospital to show how
they invaded it,
and it became something that yummy mummies would do on a Saturday. It wasn't like activisty people, it was fun, and that actually did get to a point where it could have done some damage.
The intruders,
yes,
they,
that was
but
good.
That's activism rather than satire.
I suppose what we're saying, though, in the time of YouTube.
Activism, so that, you know, you have a joke involved in your action, and then you kind of.
But I think to return to Gladwell, though, he's talking about a pretty specific form of satire,
isn't he, which is
kind of taking pot shots at politicians and comedians specifically.
I think it re-entrenches people. You see, I mean, I mentioned this last time, but there was this great podcast, Pod Save America, and they talked about how 70% of Republicans really identified with what Trump had done. And I sort of think it's kind of a bit like what you were saying when you don't identify with those other people. It's just driving them away. I think what we, in a way, because you're doing stuff for the BBC as well, it's kind of part of our remit. Like, you have to have balance. You know, you have to kind of go after everyone. But that's really important because humour is like such an important British tool. I think in a way through the podcast as well, through all 12 of them, I'm realizing that it is such a unique thing, this British use of humor, the way we use it in social situations, but the way we use it with our politicians. You literally get your hands cut off in some countries or Pussy Riot. You know, what they did in that church wasn't that different to what we did, politicians. They
Gladwell,
got locked up.
Like, Gladwell is the sort of archetypal kind of Clinton supporting the liberal sort of elite that essentially Brexit and Trump were supposed to be all about, you know, tearing down. And those kinds of people, I guess, a lot of people call them sort of, you know, snowflakes or whatever. But they have
easily triggered snowflakes
because they've assumed for so long that they have the moral high ground and they have this unimpeachable ethical sort of view of the world.
Right.
That they then think that certain, you know, it's like, so you just can't laugh at certain things. You can't do
it.
You know? And that, for me, is the death of honesty.
I know. I was
honesty.
Now, look, I should preface this by saying that I am in no way, you know, I don't have...
naughty views.
Political opinions that I think are particularly worth sharing or are going to do a lot of good. But sometimes, yeah, you do feel as if you need to say something or have a joke about it, and the atmosphere of not even being able to joke about it was such, like, so the deal was that I was at the NME Awards, and I'm going to talk about this probably quite a lot on my podcast
with Louis Theroux recently.
Yeah, with Louis.
I saw you there. I was going to come and say hi, and I got nervous.
So he left it to me to just DM you like he always does.
Right. But before I was giving an award to Louis, in fact, for his Scientology film. And I thought, you know, you have the option when you go up of either saying something funny before you read the thing on the card, or you just go up and say, and let's take a look at the nominations, which is what I should have done. But I was thinking, well, I should say something silly, I suppose. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go up and I'm going to say, because there'd been a lot of, it was awards season, and there'd been a lot of passionate speeches that you'd seen at awards about, you know, these are dark times, and we've all got to come together as a creative community and stand up for what is right in the face of Trump, etc., which I sort of agree with. But there had been a lot of those speeches. So I thought it would be funny to go up and say, look, these are dark times and these are troubled times. So that's why I think it's really, really important that we as creative people come together and just give Donald Trump a chance. Because I think he's got a lot of good, fun ideas. And you never know, it might work out really well. So why don't we all do that? Let's all make a real effort to just be positive about Donald Trump. And so at the last minute, you know, and people went on before me, and the NME editor went up and did one of those kind of dark time speeches, and MIA went up and was talking about it. And I was like, fuck, this is not going to play. this is not going to land, so I won't do it. In the end, I went up and made some lame joke about, I went up and
you
sort
should
of
have
said,
done the Trump one.
Can we, because it was incredibly loud at this award ceremony in Brixton Academy.
Right?
It was like a gig. You know, last time I went to the NME Awards, it was totally different, really hokey thing. But anyway, this time it was like a massive loud speaker system, and I was like, can we just turn it down? Is there any way we can turn it down a little bit, because the bass is really going through me? When Wiley was playing, I think it dislodged something in my bowels. Anyway, total indifference from the audience, and I carried on and sort of shambled through my bit. But then a few days later, I was doing I love this band Spoon, American band, and they were playing at the 100 Club in Oxford Street. And they got in touch and they said, do you want to do a little warm-up for us before we go on stage? We haven't got a warm-up.
Wow.
And so I was like, yeah, I'd love to. And so I thought, here we go. I'll do my Trump joke. And so I go up.
Oh, no.
And I do my whole thing about, like, so look, these are dark times. And I do the whole thing. And total silence.
Oh, God.
And on the punchline.
On the punchline, right? Absolute silence. Look, just jaws almost dropping, right? And a guy at the back goes, you know, and I say, you know, because I think Trump's got a lot of good ideas, a lot of fun ideas that we should think about. Someone at the back goes, like what?
Oh no!
And so then I just sort of fudged it, and I think I totally folded on the bit, right?
Because I'm too gutless.
And then later on, I saw Louis was there that night. Actually, he liked Spoon as well, so we went along to this show together. And he's like, "Nice job, man." Because the rest of the set was okay. It wasn't like amazing, but it was fine. And Louis was like, "Yeah, that was good, man. That was good." The Donald Trump thing didn't work, did it?
And you've also known him since you were like 12.
Yeah,
or something,
yeah, yeah.
But in relation to that, people take things so fucking seriously. I had this thing the other day. This is a social media anecdote. And I was sent a meme by my Syrian friend. My Muslim Syrian friend sent me this meme saying, he was like, lol, look at this. And it was a picture of a Muslim man looking very distressed, you know, sort of archetypal, I guess, stereotypical looking Muslim man with a beard. And he's looking very stressed and he's holding his head. And the meme says around him, it says, when you lose your son at the mall and his name is Allah Akbar. Right. So I posted this, right, thinking, you
I'm
know,
not laughing at
I've
that.
I've essentially it's essentially been signed off by a Muslim, so this is fine. And I said to my friend, I said, I'm going to post this, and all my sort of snowflake liberal friends are going to lose their shit. So I posted it. Two other Muslim friends were like, this is hilarious. Then two people, one who's not practicing Muslim, the other who's not Muslim at all, got very offended. Then there was this huge debate, and other people were getting involved, being like, I thought this was a bit off when Hayden posted it. Then Oz said it was okay, and he's Muslim, so I thought it was okay. Then somebody else said it wasn't, so I really don't know how I feel about this now. And it caused this huge debate. And ultimately, I took it down because another Muslim friend said that he found it offensive. But it's like, I don't know. I guess it
but
was
that's
kind
the Real
of
Housewives of ISIS people, all over again. It's like there are taboos around humour at certain times. Like something that I found really interesting, one of the more interesting sort of aftershocks of this thing was being at an event where there were some, you know, pretty decent, you know, well-known comedians who started saying to me that what you forget is that when The Life of Brian came out back in the, when was it? It's like late
1980, I think.
1980.
79.
Yeah, 79. That there were huge Christian protests outside the cinemas. You know, going, this is blasphemous, this is disgusting. And, you know, giant demonstrations about it. That when, you know, humour is job. I mean, like, you know, if I watch Life of Brian now, I don't imagine anyone would say anything like, apart from that's really funny.
Yeah.
You know,
no,
but in the time, it's kind of like unnecessary, because when we're talking about like satire and stuff like that, what I think it can do is it can make things easier to talk about. And that is so important, because in Britain, we've been pretty good at doing that. And in America, it seems like, you know, with the no platforming thing or whatever. Like,
yeah, but this is what I was thinking, though, because it, with my lame Trump joke, and it was a lame joke, like it was never going to bring the house down, but it was just supposed to be like a riff on the whole, you know, the whole award show trope of getting up there and feeling as if you have to say, you know, come on, we're actors. It's very important for us to get together and hold hands and change things.
And like, and it's Meryl Streep.
As much as I agree with that, after you've seen it on every single award show, you just sort of think, what's the point of saying, you know, this is just...
Well, I've heard even more stuff like, you know, there's a quite well-known actress that I know, and she was told carte blanche that if she went onto the red carpet with a sort of like fuck Trump thing, that would be it for her in the movie industry.
Right.
That they've got to a point now where, like, okay, so if you're Meryl Streep, you can stand up.
Everyone does it.
No, you can only do it if you're a certain level.
Yeah.
If you're Meryl Streep, you're going to get jobs, right? Because you're fucking Meryl Streep. But if you're an up and coming actress and you want to talk about your thing, they're just like literally half your audience gone straight away.
Yes.
And the thing is that, like, we live in weird times, you see. So it's like, the entertainment
you forget
industry
people
is a huge paradox.
Trump, don't you?
Well, this is the thing.
They also go to movies.
This is what Louis was saying. He was like, you know, the joke was never going to land because it's fundamentally, it's not obvious enough why it's funny. And also, there are a lot of people who do think Trump has a lot of good ideas.
Yeah.
And, and... you know,
you were so in the bubble.
It's,
you were so in the bubble,
exactly.
Adam. You didn't even get
it's true.
That your joke.
It's true.
Was,
and it immediately became something. It's but it's odd to feel like actually no, you can't joke about that. You have to be, clear about what you're saying in these areas, and you think that's antithetical to comedy. Surely,
yeah, for sure.
Like, surely the whole point is you can fucking joke about it. You can joke about anything you want, and people have to make a reasonable assessment on where you're coming from.
But look at Peter Geddon,
and not
like,
just take it, not just take it as a superficial statement to be read literally.
Yeah,
you know, you have to. You're It's like a two-way, it's a two-person relationship as a comedian and the audience. You're inviting the audience to make a little leap.
Yeah. Mm.
And they can't just sit there on the other side of the ravine and watch you fall to your death. Or they can if they want. But it's more fun if, you know, if they come to you and they think about, like, okay, so this guy said this superficially unpleasant or strange thing, but... where's he coming from? Is he definitely someone who's a bit racist, or is he definitely someone who's, you know, or is this maybe a satire or a silly joke? Okay, maybe it's a joke, but maybe it's not very funny, but I'm not going to just immediately go on Twitter and trash the person because, you know, they made a joke that didn't really land, and we'll give them a pass this time.
Yeah.
Kind of thing,
Adam, what have you brought us for our dessert? Or pudding, if you prefer.
Do you say dessert or pudding, by the way?
I would say pudding.
I knew you'd say pudding. Adam Buxton's a typical pudding
saying. It's part of the we're dividing, you see. What's your favourite dessert?
Pudding. My favourite pudding.
Pudding.
Well,
pudding.
I do
pudding.
An extended
come on.
Piece in my live shows about those goo puddings.
Oh, they are amazing, aren't they?
I never mention them by their brand name when I'm doing them live because I'm not sponsored or anything, but...
but soon, maybe.
I talk about them as being puddings designed for a person of my specific social class, which is middle premium. They
so
are,
good, middle premium. That's great.
Because of the free glass ramekin.
I know, I love them.
Do you take them home and use them for your own creme brulee?
I mean, this is all part of my stupid routine. I've got
millions of ramekins.
Millions of them.
Do you take the time to warm it up, or do you just I nail it?
Do you put warm it up?
You can heat them up,
Adam. I want to know what you do with your ramekins. Do you put little tea lights in them?
Well, this is You see, I cover all this in my hilarious routine
on your dinner parties.
But that's the idea. Yeah. But it's never happened. So I've just got cupboards full of, I would guess, at around maybe 500.
500 ramekins.
500 ramekins. That's all the argot.
Over what period of time have you accumulated
this 500
ramekins?
Years, but I mean, I do. I eat less of them now than I used to.
Sure.
And I could have done with eating about 500 less in total. But
have you been cut off by your wife? Has she been like, look,
she
Adam,
was the one.
Enough
that,
of
she
these
was
ramekins.
The one that got me into them. She was the enabler. There.
She really.
She used to come back
addictive.
With them because she knew how much I liked them. And Friday, I'd get back from a hard day of reading YouTube comments.
Walking Rosie
would serve me a. She'd like, look in the fridge. There's a treat for you.
Yeah.
This is my rock and roll
special
life.
Special Fridays.
And it would be the, first of all, it was the banoffee pie.
Oh, that's a good one.
And then by accident, I got the gazillionaire one.
Oh, shut up. That's the one, isn't it? That's the three-layered chocolate bad
more
boy.
More than three layers.
I mean, it is just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of textures.
So what about your, would you be more of a bread and butter pudding guy or a creme brulee guy?
Well, I don't like either of those, but
right,
it would
that's
be,
it. It's not in either of our camps.
Creme brulee.
Yes! So there you go. Another creme brulee there.
Well, maybe I've never had the right bread and butter pudding. I don't know.
I don't think you have.
Are there raisins in there?
Yeah.
Adam.
Oh, it sounds
Adam,
good.
Adam, it's good. Don't. And I custard. See what you're doing, Adam.
I'm trying to be liked.
He's trying to go. He's all right. We're all trying to be liked.
So moving on to your metaphorical discursive dessert.
Katie.
Tell us about this. This is Katy Perry's new album.
Katy Perry. So this is a video that we showed at Bug. I mean, it's a brilliant song.
So she's in a theme park.
And the theme park is called Oblivia.
What does that mean?
I don't know if you know, but oblivion is a state of forgetfulness.
Right.
And being disconnected from rational thought.
Right.
And so this is a whole theme park.
So
Disneyland
it's almost a place
style
where people
theme park.
Lose themselves.
Yeah, right. Or cut themselves off from what's really important from real life.
And she's here got a very lovely kind of pink hairdo and some sort of space age thing that almost looks like a little bit like you could see it in
and
a kind
Instagramming
of Gattaca.
Yes, so this is a futuristic utopian theme park vision. And I've been told that there is a episode of Black Mirror, the most recent series, that's a little bit like this. I haven't seen the
Nose
most
dive.
Recent series.
Yes, it is.
And I know that Katie obviously used to have a relationship with Russell Brand. I would imagine that Russell Brand would have turned her on to a lot of British stuff, not least Black Mirror. But I know that at a certain point, Americans really got with Black Mirror, and it's been a big deal over there. And so Katie's obviously one of those people that's seen it. And I'm not saying that to dismiss out of hand what she's doing here. But this video is very dense, and it's a really well-made video.
Yeah. Very expensive.
And this is I forget the director's name, but he's worked with her before and he's a very accomplished director. And so you've got Katie on these roller coasters and
lots of likes and emojis and hearts, and there seems to be a general sense here that people are living for a very aesthetically pleasing
sort of superficial culture, and they're satirizing
Black Mirror there.
They're satirizing, you know, the whole selfie culture and people.
And Katy Perry, obviously, who we shouldn't forget, after the result was announced of the election, suddenly started tweeting, resist, and stand up. More akin to what you'd expect from a sort of Black Panther account rather than lovely old Katy Perry.
What problem do you have with this video, Adam Buxton?
Well, you're assuming I have a problem with it.
Well, you don't.
It's the easiest thing in the world to be cynical about, obviously, because Katy Perry is someone who you could easily characterize as a kind of pampered individual who's presumably made a lot of money doing what they do, selling pop/pap to
pop pap
to young people mainly, and here they are suddenly, when it suits them at a certain point, peddling a kind of subversive,
superficially
subversive agenda, and saying, "Come on, wake up!
Yeah.
You're all, you know, taking selfies and worrying about your Instagram accounts while there's fracking going on, and there's." You know,
there's other stuff as well as
fracking. I like the way when she's in the cinema halfway through and she's in her world where she's obviously in her little bubble, and then Bob Marley's great grandson obviously comes on stage and wakes her up with his reggae vibes.
Here's the thing though, I fancy Katy Perry, and I've always have. I think she's an amazing, beautiful woman, and I think it's too easy to be too cynical about this because, one, I can't imagine how difficult it is to traverse that industry and to become an absolute behemothic creature. And, like, fair enough, you know, she's at a point now where she can basically say whatever she wants. I mean, basically, if she just put out some weird kind of, like, titillation video of watching two fingers, you know...
But isn't Katy Perry part of the problem? Isn't that the problem? That essentially...
I want to hear about what the fingers are doing.
Well, I sort of was thinking more that they were turned into kind of finger puppets and they did some kind of, you know, Pavel thing. Yeah. But it's like, it's not really... I'm saying I think we've got a real issue here because, actually, I think it's far beyond the point where any cultural icon could start say anything without missing their brand sponsorship. And it's a bit with, like, you know, going back to our last course, is it not the point more that she's got to a point where she just doesn't give a shit and she can just say whatever she wants?
Well, the point,
so what are the lyrics? Let's hear these amazing lyrics.
Are we crazy, living our lives through a lens, trapped in our white picket fence like ornaments? So comfortable, we're living in a bubble. So comfortable, we cannot see the trouble. Aren't you lonely? Up there in utopia, where nothing will ever be enough, happily numb. So comfortable, we're living in a bubble. So comfortable, we cannot see the trouble.
So I think you get the idea.
And no then more, please. Can we continue into the second stanza?
Well, the chorus, which is... I mean, I should say as well that the more I see this video when we show it at Bug, the more I like it and the more I like the song as
can
well.
Can you keep the rendition going, though?
Turn it up. It's your favourite song. Dance, dance, dance to the distortion. Turn it up. Keep it on repeat. Stumbling around like a wasted zombie. Yeah. We think we're free. Aha. Drink this. Drink. This one's on me. We're all chained to the rhythm. To the rhythm. Turn it up. It's your favourite song. Dance, 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 etc. Are we tone deaf? Keep sweeping it under the mat. Thought we could do better than that. I hope we can. And then Skip Marley comes out. Skipping on a bit.
Yeah,
further.
Skip Marley.
Oh, my God.
What does he say?
He says, "Hello, I'm Skip Marley. It is my desire. Break down the walls to connect, inspire, eh? Up in your high place, liars! Time is ticking for the Empire! The truth they feed is feeble, as so many times before. They greed over the people..." That's not proper grammar. "They stumbling and fumbling..." Again, bad grammar. "And we about to riot! They woke up! They woke up the lions! Woo!"
So there's a lot going on.
Mm. What do you think the subtext is in that?
It's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
What does it all mean?
Those lyrics.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong, is there, with saying that we should all
being a bit snooty.
Think more about what's going on in the world and be a bit less focused on ourselves and our own vanity and think less about our own comfort and consider more the inequality that there is in the world. There's nothing wrong with considering that, is there? And there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with a person like Katy Perry making that almost the norm of discourse by making it the guts of a pop song. But the danger is that you just make it all more banal noise, more sort of white noise, and that actually it just gets subsumed. The machine just chews it up and spits it out.
In a way, you're saying the same thing that you were saying earlier about satire. You're kind of saying that she's undermining any genuine sort of political action by just turning it into candy floss.
Yeah, well, there's two ways of looking at it. I mean, again, cursed by my wishy-washy, both sides of the coin attitude.
This is why we love you, Buckles.
You could say that it's very, very valuable and even, dare I say it, brave of someone like, because she will have, I mean, I've read a lot of the comments. She is reaping all kinds of whirlwinds.
But also, Buckles, in a sort of like, if I was a psychoanalyst who had a lovely couch, leather couch maybe, in a sort of slightly sunken, darkened room in a kind of old Victorian house on Frognall in Hampstead, what I might say is that, Buckles, when we first started talking about this, you talked about the influences on your life. Mm. The musicians that had touched you had shaped you, no less,
right,
into the person that you actually have become.
There you go, yes.
And the thing is that actually, let's just think that her audience is probably anything from like 7-6 years old to actually real adults. And the thing is that actually a lot of the studies that I've seen of, I think they're now calling them Generation Z or, you know, zero or whatever comes after X and Y. Yeah. You know, they are really only interested in experiences. They're all absolutely massive environmentalists. They don't understand how anyone couldn't be. And they kind of look to people like her as kind of like these icons who are just about saying something. I mean, I find it very interesting bringing it back to sort of the God Children thing that my 13-year-old godson recently told me that he's never going to have a smartphone. And
I said, why?
And he went, because they listen to you.
Ooh,
and I just went, oh, yeah, no, I've completely just accepted that.
He's been woke.
He's been pure woke. But there's the, you know, that old Nokia phone is coming out again and the kids are kind of getting into it. And kind of in a way, it's kind of Donald Trump is this 70-year-old, you know, sort of orange man. But maybe the kids are going to do good stuff. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, mate, you've got to fundamentally hope that people aren't just shitbags.
I know, right?
You have to hope that, you know, we are all in it together and that we do want on some level to coexist peacefully and that we just have radically different ideas of the best way to do that and that we're fed up with people who or that some of us are fed up with people who bollock on about it but never seem to actually do anything about it or you know, I mean, it's got to the point where everyone seems to be pulling for the same team philosophically, but actually they're so divided on how you actually do that.
Because I feel like that I look at Instagram accounts probably not too dissimilar from ours, where, you know, it's just so trendy and fashionable to be at a protest that's an anti-Trump protest and, you know, really standing up for feminism or refugees or this or that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, four pictures down, you're in the Bahamas and you're having your incredible holiday on a white on a sandy beach. And if you're a kind of like, you know, Brexiteer that's been fucked over for the last 10 years and you look at an Instagram account like that, you'd be so sort of repulsed from that sort of pseudo-revolutionary kind of tokenism that exists, which is kind of what Katy Perry's doing. She, like, it is an unfair system, and Katy Perry is a beneficiary of that.
Yeah.
And really and truly, if you were to sit Katy Perry down and ask her if she was prepared to vote for a system which would tax her a fuck of a lot more in order to hand a lot of that, you know, money she's accumulated back to the people that have been shafted by the capitalist system, she'd probably be like, fuck off.
Well, you're making massive assumptions because we don't know Katy Perry personally, and everything that I've heard
I'm just
people
saying,
who
I'm
do
using her
actually
as a...
she's quite radical. But I also think that we've got to be very careful about this because, look, I mean, particularly for a female artist in a world dominated by men who understands her own sexuality, how that sells, who understands how to utilise kind of a medium to get any kind of subversive message in, and in American pop music, that ain't no easy thing because, you know, like you're talking about the whole of the Midwest, you know, the Bible Belt, all
saying,
of this market.
Of course,
hang on, because the point we're making here is, should these people do that? And my personal opinion is, fuck yes. That's my personal opinion because I think that actually we're living in a time where any sort of like
in a bubble. I also realised that I said something monumentally crass just now, which was sort of we're all kind of basically, you know, singing from the same hymn sheet, but we have different ideas about. Actually, that's probably bullshit, isn't it? Because manifestly, there are a lot of people who are quite cunty and who don't have people's best interests at heart, and those people do need to be stood up to. Mm. But it is very confusing for all of us trying to think of the best way of doing that, and without
But we live in fucked up
times. And still holding on to the things that you do enjoy about the modern world and about being privileged and, you know.
It's difficult, but it's like what you've been saying, and I think what a huge amount of people will empathise with when you've been talking, is that it's kind of one way and you kind of got to look at the other hand of it. And that's not very in vogue at the minute. What's very in vogue is being like either, you know, as Brooker said at his screen wipe that we've talked about many times, you're either, you know, the internet used to be meh. Now it's either you're a, you know, racist or a metropolitan elite. It's like these tags don't work. And I think most people, you know, feel like that.
Yeah.
Normal people.
Well, you know, I just don't run into people in the physical world who converse in the way that most people on Twitter do. They don't, you have a discussion. You talk about things. You say, oh, gosh, I'm not sure I agree with that. But you do so in a way that isn't offensive to them and doesn't make them feel stupid, and you carry on talking.
But maybe this is the thing, you know, like we were all kind of taught on some level some kind of table manners or kind of how to behave in the real world, but there's no real digital table manners, is there? No one really, there's no book of like, oh, listen, you, this is how you behave, you know, some people.
No, it'll be fascinating in when my children are grown up to see how they treat each other. I do think people will look back at these times now and think, fucking hell, that was a strange period of history.
So listen, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. What's coming up that we can look forward to? Is the podcast coming back?
Yeah.
We're so excited for it to be back.
Oh, well, thanks. I hope you enjoy it. I mean,
it's
my
faves.
You know how hard it is getting guests. And sometimes it's really tricky. You hope to just talk to people you're interested in, but you know that it would be great if you had people that, you know, your audience had immediately heard of, because those are the most attractive ones for them to click on. But you kind of have to trust people after a while. And you hope that they're going to go, well, all right, so I haven't heard of that person.
I know.
But it might be fun. And you just
definitely. Those are the ones I found most fun, actually.
It's often the way, isn't it? Yeah. But with the podcasts I listen to, if you buy into the podcast as a whole and you think, oh, okay, and you end up finding out about someone you'd never heard of. Anyway, so I do have a few big or quite well-known names. I mean, Brian Eno, I've got.
Ooh, wow, that's you're a big Brian Eno fan, aren't you?
I love him so much.
I've been really getting into listening to Brian Eno when I write recently.
Oh, yeah, it's good. It's good to work to. Yeah. Which one? The ambient stuff?
The ambient stuff, like the airport music.
Apollo, have you got that one?
I think, is that, it's incredibly long.
Atmospheres and soundtracks.
Yeah.
That's the one with Daniel Lanois. It's got the one that was used in Train Spotting when he goes into the toilet. You know,
right, when he goes down.
Love him. Absolutely love him. So that was good talking to him.
Wowza.
And even though he's someone who doesn't like to look back too much, I mean, that's always the thing with people who are quite well established and well known, is that you have to tiptoe around them a bit more.
Yeah, it was tough when you were talking to Palin. I could tell that there was like moments where you were like, I don't want to go that
far back. You don't want to be that guy, because I think Brian Eno was interviewed by a Guardian journalist at the beginning of this year, and it was clearly an uncomfortable encounter, and the journalist was sort of bent out of shape by Eno's reluctance to talk about the things that I guess a lot of people want to know about. What was it like working with Bowie, with Talking Heads?
It's pretty fair, isn't it? You just want to talk about what he's done.
Yeah. But Eno was like, you're a journalist. I've talked about it before. You can look it up.
Yeah. Talk to me about my art that
all
I'm
that's
making.
Been said. Yeah, let's have a conversation about what's going on now. You know, there's a lot to talk about in the modern world. If you think I'm in any way an interesting person, I suppose from their point of view, if you just want to focus on these things that have been talked about a lot, it's like you're saying, that was the only interesting thing you ever did.
It's bloody fair enough, though, isn't it? It's bloody fair enough.
I think it is. But having said that, we had two sessions, and the second session we ended up, because he only does, like, he's very strict about only allotting an hour for any kind of interview. So I didn't realise that. So when the hour was suddenly up, it was like, oh, shit, we've only just got going.
Oh, wow,
so
that's
I went
tough.
Back, and for the second session, we actually ended up talking about a few things that were part of his career. My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, this amazing album that he did with David Byrne in the early 80s, and writing his songs for Another Green World. And anyway, so
as a small
podcast,
aside,
basically, yeah.
Do you ever think that Adam sounds a bit like Louis Theroux?
It's been said. We have the same cadences.
Some kind of inflection. Yeah. Or something, and I wonder who that came
up
from first.
Probably a bigger boy.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Probably both copying a
bigger
boy.
I'm sure we feed
boy.
Off a little bit, probably. But Louis always had that kind of intonation, and I'm certainly a bit of a sponge when it comes
no,
to...
No, you've had this like same that. Voice from the beginning.
Oh, I do, definitely, yeah. No, but we all gradually morphed yeah. into each other a little bit yeah. when we were
but
at school.
But you do, and you find little jokes yeah, and cadences yeah, yeah. that kind of like come
it's just
with
nice.
That.
It's nice seeing that something that's sort of like...
But no, I do, I definitely pick up on voices. Like, I think a lot of people think that the whole my wife thing is me doing... Papa Lazaru from the League of Gentlemen.
Yeah.
But that was never in my mind at all. That was about, and it came
you're
from,
my wife now.
Exactly. Yeah. But it is very. It's
so hang on. Also, you're doing some
that's
quite
more
big.
Like that.
You're doing
wife.
Some big live things as well, aren't you?
Who actually, incidentally, is very like Tom in Taboo. Tom, what's he called?
Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy oh. in Taboo. Oh. Can you see the similarities? Papa Lazaru and Tom Hardy in Taboo.
Yes. I love Tom Hardy.
It's good fun doing Tom Hardy. I can't do. Impressions no, it's more without like this. Listening to him, but
no, it's more like this. Look, no, it's quicker.
Right. Who can do the best Tom Hardy?
Well, it's sometimes a little bit like Anthony Hopkins.
You will work for me.
No, he goes, you will work for me now. Yeah, he does yeah, that.
You will work for
that's
me.
Right. You, yeah, but you will do what I say.
It's got the slight Welsh thing coming
yes,
through.
Yes, that's right. It's a very
my
Welsh
favourite one
inflection.
Is Strilbane. Well, I think he tried to talk backwards.
Who's that?
That's Bane.
Oh, Bane, yeah. yes.
Yeah. He has got one.
That's quite good. Sounds like Mr. Bean. Mr. Bane.
If you pull the air into your mouth, you go,
who has died now?
It's so good. That's I watched good. That again. Yeah. Bloody hell, that yeah. was amazing. Anyway, listen. Sorry. So what else have we got coming up? Because listen,
yeah,
Buckles,
no, it's mainly podcast. I've been enjoying myself doing a
so
podcast.
So great. I just want to tell you, I've loved all your stuff, but I think you're finding your thing. It's so you.
Your podcast
I love
is
all
my
the
favorite
music.
Podcast.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yours, it was, oh, it's what nice. Got us in. Yeah. We was the first podcast I properly started listening yeah. to.
You
I'm
were
sure
I'm
tons
pretty quick on the uptake
with
podcasts, weren't you? You were like, this is going to be a thing.
Only by default, only because we were at XFM in 2006 and Gervais and Stephen Merchant had done their podcast.
Right. Yeah.
And so we just thought, oh, yeah, we'll do that too.
Yeah, yeah.
So we owe them a debt, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, I mean, other than the podcast, I mean, I carry on doing live shows. I do Bug
yeah.
at the BFI every few months and then we do Bug specials. And I'm still actually doing the David Bowie special, which we started doing after his death.
Oh, amazing. I'd love to see that.
And now it's kind of, it evolves a little bit and I can't resist adding things to it. And also I'm gradually learning it as well. Because usually with the Bug shows, they're 2-hour shows. So it's a whole new 2-hour show each time. So I have to read off a script that I've written. But now I'm sort of memorizing it. And so I'm hoping that it'll become quite a
Edinburgh.
Different thing.
I want to come to the next Bug. Can I come to the next Bug? It'd be
oh man, you're always welcome. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let me know.
We will so be there. Listen. I just want to say, you know, Adam Buxton, our penultimate guest in series one of our news roast. Thank you so much for listening. Please, you know, keep letting us know. I know some of you have said, well, why aren't these guests appearing? Well, it's because it takes a while to sort of like get in contact, but yes. particularly all the female suggestions have been really, really great. Please,
it's tough, man,
to
isn't
the
it?
Podcast.
Because
yeah.
I have taken on board the. You know, I would love to get my podcast way more diverse than it is. It's but the reality right. is that, you know, the people that return your emails are other white guys. If you happen to grow up in a mainly male white environment as I did, then those are the people that are your oldest friends, and they're the people that return your emails. And I do try and reach out to a lot of other people who are not just white blokes, and for whatever reason it's just much yeah. harder to get people
we'll help
in touch.
Us. We'll get you
they're
in
not
touch
as interested in self-promotion as white blokes.
yeah.
White blokes.
Single
yes, I'm wearing a podcast, that's fine.
Single white men.
Give me a date and time.
Most interested
this
in
this is a whole, we won't go down a whole other conversational rabbit hole. But I think, you know, people, as much as they want to be diverse and cross-pollinate, people tend to sort of stick to the things they know, don't they? And they don't do it because they're racist or sexist. That's just the way people are.
It's just a podcast. Yeah. Three white men in a room. So just want to say thanks so much, Adam, for coming on. Guys, we'll see you next time on News Roast. Bye-bye.
Cheerio, bye.
Bye.
What do you want from a Thomas Cook holiday?
I want to chill out. ready for your massage, man.
I want adventure.
Want a great value late getaway this summer? With Thomas Cook, you can fly to beautiful sun-kissed destinations from over 20 airports around the UK. Visit your local Thomas Cook store today or go to thomascook.com. Conditions and credit card fees apply. Atoll protected.